Welcome back. This is Raise Your Average. I'm Pierre Daly, Managing Editor at AdvisorAnalyst.com. Co-hosting with me is Mike Philbrick, CEO at Resolve Asset Management. Mike?
How are you today, Pierre?
Awesome. How about you?
I'm great. We got one of the best handles on Twitter with us today. Bob E. Unlimited. Are you kidding me? Unlimited funds. I'm often reminded of Wile E. Coyote, one of the most savvy predators in the Arizona desert when I hear Bob's name. But can't wait to dig in with Bob today.
Also, what an awesome name for a fund company.
Yeah. Right? He nailed it.
That's right. It was a little bit of a play on, highly limited partnership. So we're trying to bring it to everybody. Nice. Bring, 2 in 20 strategies to everybody.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of AdvisorAnalyst.com or of our guests. This broadcast is meant to be for informational purposes only. Nothing discussed in this broadcast is intended to be considered as advice.
So, yeah, Bob Elliott, co-founder, chief executive officer, and chief investment officer of Unlimited Funds, is with us today. Bob, it's awesome to have you on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I want to give you just a bit of a preamble, Bob. I know, many people know you from Twitter and from 2 decades of experience. But so first, a little bit about Bob. Bob brings over 2 decades of experience building innovative, systematic investment strategies across the universe of asset classes. He's most notably an ex-Bridgewater exec, where he spent 15 years and ultimately led Ray Dalio's research team for over 10 of those years. Bob launched Unlimited Funds in 2022 to bring hedge fund strategies, once only available to ultra high net worth investors and institutions, to everyday investors by way of significantly lower costing hedge fund replication strategies in ETF wrappers. So, Bob, before we get into our conversation, I'm dying to find out more about your time at Bridgewater. In particular, what was it like to be there pre and post the GFC? And what were some of the lessons that you learned, since?
For, I think, most investors, the early years of their investment careers, like, very much sort of frame the way that they think about the world. And for me, I started sort of professionally. I dabbled in markets starting in the late 90s and early 2000s, and then started professionally in markets in 2005. And it was a really interesting period to basically see one of the largest credit booms in the history, build up, and asset price booms build up and then come down, and with all of the second and third order consequences that came. And, it was a time where, I think one of the key things I learned through that time was that having a fresh set of eyes on these dynamics was actually super useful. Like, for, I think both of you guys were trading through that period and investing through that period. And, many people came to that dynamic and basically said, house prices never go down, defaults never happen, AAAs never get eaten through, only in the Great Depression, which was, in nominal GDP terms, a 35% decline in nominal GDP, which it was, was implausible to happen. And they sort of looked at all that and they sort of blocked themselves from the range of plausible outcomes. And I was fortunate at the time leading Bridgewater's research on the risks and likely magnitudes of the GFC to really see and understand, to have fresh eyes, to come at it with that fresh perspective, that curious perspective. No particular biases one way or another. I didn't walk in when I started to think about what the size of the losses were or what the consequences of banks would be. I had no predisposition in one direction or another. I just came at it from a very open-minded perspective. And also, I think that open-minded perspective allowed me to draw on a lot of expertise. I'd been in the markets for a few years, but I was able to, fortunately, given the institution I was at, to be able to basically be able to call on experts everywhere, right? And experts who in and of themselves were very smart, very capable, understood their area, but maybe didn't see the bigger picture. And so the other thing that I think was super valuable was getting outside of the narrowness of a particular vein and saying, okay, let's talk about the macroeconomic dynamics of house prices. What does that mean for credit losses? What does that mean for our financial intermediaries? What does that mean for credit creation? What does that mean for asset prices? Painting that whole picture, which really meant talking to a bunch of people who are experts in each one of those pieces and synthesizing all that information together, was another sort of critical lesson from the experience. And so it was only sort of through that curiosity and that desire to get the holistic perspective that we were able to, you know, figure out that there were going to be trillions of dollars of losses and, you know, that the banking system was in trouble, to say the least.
Yeah. And so, I mean, given that you had access to, you know, Bridgewater's network of advisors and you know, macroeconomics and, you know, really, I would guess that, you know, given Bridgewater's position at the time, that it was an unusual advantage and to come in with fresh eyes is kind of investigative work, right? You're not coming in with any sort of preconceived notions about what's going on, but you had to listen to people, you know, all sorts of opinions right across the entire universe of opinions about whether or not, you know, we were heading into a disaster, because there was a lot of conflicting messages, as you pointed out. But what were some of the really big clues for you, you know, as you know, in the lead role in investment research that sort of uncovered the opportunities that Bridgewater was able to, you know, benefit its investors from?
Yeah, I think a lot of the sort of key insight, which I think permeates all good macroeconomic investing, was the ability to go all the way down to the granular level to say, I remember pricing the possibility of losses in subprime AAA, you know, mortgage pools based upon, you know, where the housing stock was, that were the references and the loan structures and stuff like that, all the way down to that level, and then start to work your way up, essentially building the macroeconomic perspective, but seeing it not from sort of a high level lens. Like, you know, there's lots of people who will sort of say, oh, well, let me just sort of generally opine on what's going on. What I think was unique about the perspective there, and I think a critical part of what I learned through that experience, is get granular, work through the granular, and the macro is really just a buildup of all the granular things that are going on, right? So, you know, the bank's losses and the acute losses in the equity market were actually a function of the geographic composition of AAA, subprimes, you know, RMBS that were being issued. And so if you just sort of looked at the banks generally, you might not see it. But if you saw the granular and then went up, you could really build up a holistic picture. I think that's a clear, you know, that was a very important part. The other thing, which was, I think, super important through that time, was the value of triangulating the views. And so, you know, part of the benefit of being in that institution was we were able to knock on a lot of doors and talk to a lot of people who were, you know, inside, whether they be government officials inside or companies themselves. And we did that in a way, you know, there's one the sort of typical analyst way of doing that is you like come in and you're like, I have my point of view and I'm trying to like score points. We just came in, you know, with our big sheets of paper with lots of numbers on them and just said, hey, look, this is how we think things are going. Like, what do you agree with? What do you disagree with? Where do we get this wrong? You know, and work again from the bottoms up. Now that led to some interesting stories. Like, for instance, when we were having lunch at the Federal Reserve in of New York, and you know, Geithner was across the table, and we basically, you know, I just went through and said, "Here are the numbers, and it looks like the whole banking system is broke." You know, if you start with going through all the numbers, and then you get to the conclusion, You know, that was a pretty interesting conversation. And it was also pretty interesting that that was a surprise to the New York Fed, you know, in the winter before 2008. So, you know, I think all of those stories, all of those dynamics, were sort of all the sort of key lessons learned. And honestly, I feel like those sorts of things are things that I see like every single day. I keep in practice every single day, over the last 20 years.
I can't help feeling like there's probably like 100 stories that that are just a blur, you know, some of which are a blur to you because it feels like it was 100 years ago now. Right. You know,
It feels 100 years ago, but, it was, you know, there's those moments in anyone's career where there's, I'd say like very rapid learning. And it was one of the times probably of the most rapid learning and understanding, both in terms of like method, but also just getting a great sense of what was going, how the whole system worked together. That I think was, you know, anyways, it's incredible. Still lives with me today. I got a little flashback with SVB, but not quite the same size or magnitude by any stretch, but it was fun to dabble back into bank losses and risks again.
Well, Bob, what are you seeing today? Or are you seeing anything today that, you know, rhymes or, you know, potentially looks like some of the dislocations that you saw in 08?
Mm-hmm.
Are any of those dislocations as serious as they might have been in 08? What are you seeing in today's macroeconomic conditions and the potential for regime shift? And obviously inflation has a specter that is hanging over the markets. So anything there that you're seeing, any corollaries, or is this a little bit unique? What's the same? What's different?
Well, I think a lot of the dynamics that are going on right now that sort of surprised many market participants were the consequence of that GFC period. And in the 15 years post GFC, both in the moment and the 15 years post GFC, you know, I was in the sort of lucky position to work with policymakers around the, let's say, the evolution of the regulatory frameworks and the incentives, really, in terms of how to restructure the economy. And, you know, basically what happened over the 15 years post GFC up until COVID was we totally restructured the nature of debt in the U.S. economy. It's hard to believe, but back in 2007, 50% of U.S. mortgages were floaters. You know, average LTVs were between 90 and 100 at the time. Now, both of those things are just non-existent today, right? Essentially, 100% are longer duration, 100% of mortgages are longer duration fixed loans. And LTVs, you know, except in sort of edge cases, are, you know, the 80 LTV loan is the benchmark loan that people take. You know, no negative AM loans or anything like that. That restructuring of the economy is the thing that and also the banks have been totally restructured as well, in the sense of, you know, there were banks with 3% capital, right? 30x levered on a true equity basis at the time. That doesn't exist anymore. You know, you need 10 to 15% capital to be running a bank these days. So two huge parts of the overall system that have been totally restructured. I think the thing that is, so that's created a lot of reduced sensitivity to the economy, you know, to interest rates as a function of that, which I think has surprised a lot of people. And I think the other thing that is very interesting, particularly as it relates to the CRE issue, is I think a lot of people draw a direct distinction between the CRE issue today and the financial crisis. But unless you're sort of in the bowels of how banks work, you wouldn't necessarily see the difference. Both are credit risks.
Right.
There's going to be lots of losses on CRE. No question about it. The question is not, will there be losses, just in the same way lots of losses on houses and house lending back in the GFC. The question is not, will there be losses? The question is, when do those losses have to be recognized? And there's been a total restructuring of banks to basically strip out any risky securities off their balance sheets so they don't have to be marked to market. And even, you know, even the efforts taken to, let's say, reduce the mark-to-market approach on bonds also have, you know, it's kind of the end of that series of steps. And now we have CRE. Yeah, there's going to be a few hundred billion dollars of losses, and they're going to be eaten by banks. But if it takes 15 years to recognize them, like, who cares? You know, so far banks have recognized, you know, I've earned like $100 billion in NIM on these loans and have recognized $1 billion of losses or something. You know, I mean, just like, who cares, right? If it takes 15 years, but that's really important. So people, particularly post-SVB, I think missed. They looked at CRE. They said, we're going to have a financial crisis dynamic. To be clear, the Fed missed that. The Fed sat there and said, we're going to have a CRE-driven financial crisis in the banks. They missed it, right? They should know better, but they missed it because they didn't understand, folks didn't understand how the risk exposures of banks have been totally restructured to significantly reduce the risk of a larger scale credit event through levered financial entities.
Yeah, I suppose that's a, from an economics perspective, from an economic perspective domestically in the US, that's a pretty significant advantage having mortgages that you can lock in for 30 years, mortgages which have an average duration of sort of, I've read anywhere from 7 to 10 years as interest rates rise. That is not the case in Canada, right? Canada is all of those floating rates, did reach a, you know, bubblicious level. And, you know, you can kind of lock in for 5 years is kind of the longest normal. You can get a little longer than that, but no one really does it because the rates go up substantially. But it's just interesting that different economies have different approaches to this. And Canada is going to, while it sailed through the GFC, it may have a little bit more challenge in the current paradigm just because of the structural differences in the economy. And then, yeah, you raise a great point on the CRE stuff. Now, what do you think happens there? Is it just, is everyone going to play, you know, ring around the rosy, pocket full of posy? You know, we just hold hands and circle this bad boy and, you know, have 10 years of flat returns and no, you know, nobody do anything rash.
See, I told you it's not there.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Well, I always like to say, you know,
presto.
The thing that bankers are really good at is pushing off losses in bad loans. They're not good at making loans. They're very good at pushing off losses and bad loans. And we're seeing their skill set at this. You know, there's 25 basis points of charge-offs on CRE right now. You know, and those loans, the running NIM on them is like, you know, something like 300 to 400 basis points. Like, they're doing great. And what's happening, part of that is because the loans are actually less sensitive, you know, less credit risky than I think people might have on the top of their head. They look at sort of dollar value losses of, you know, on buildings that are out there and don't realize that most of those loans are 50 LTVs. So it's just, it's like not a, you know, there's a lot of cushion. A 50 LTV right. loan, yeah. it is tough to have for on a real asset, right? Because, you know, commercial real estate is essentially a real asset. Over time, it's pretty tough to experience 50% LTV loans, particularly as we've gone through a period of inflation as we have. And then even the ones that have come in, you know, they basically figure out ways to amend and pretend and sell the building for a dollar and, you know, cut the lease, you know, cut the interest rate on it. And so if you just think about that, like the average duration of a CRE loan is about between 5 and 10 years. So it takes 5 to 10 years. Before, you know, we start to, for a loan, you start to look at it and deal with the refinancing question. And then what you do is, you know, maybe they don't pay for a little bit and then you sort of push that out for a few years and then you refinance it and restructure it. And then, you know, all of a sudden, like the person who made the loan is, you know, in retirement by the time that the person's dealing with the actual losses that exist. And that's the beauty, you know, as long as the regulators comply. Meaning as long as the regulators basically like, yeah, amend, pretend, don't recognize the losses, et cetera, it's fine. It can essentially carry on for forever. And that's, you know, the regulators are certainly incentivized right now not to destroy the banking system just because they want to like recognize a few losses in CRE.
Love it. Love it. Yeah. Maybe we can, and we got Bob Elliott on from, Bob E. Unlimited and Unlimited Funds. And we're gonna talk about some of the new products that you've got coming as well. So I want everyone to stay tuned for some more granular stuff on kind of the thoughts on replication. And you've got an agile fund out that's gonna do multi-strat. So we got lots to talk about on that, but I want to stay on the global macro scenario for the moment. So just letting viewers know, we're going to get to some fun stuff too. And what isn't fun in global macro. But what are you seeing today across the inflation front? I know you've got some recent tweets that you've been working on and putting out there, and U.S. growth versus reshoring versus interest rates versus inflation versus a U.S. economy versus a global economy. There's a lot of, you know, interrelated pieces of the puzzle there. Maybe you can walk us through some of your thoughts right now on how that's going to kind of move through the system. And your new product is going to have sort of a regime-dependent type of strategy structure to it. So I'm thinking, if you can walk us through the narrative on the global macro side, then maybe we can move into how that manifests in investments and what you might think about for the viewers and listeners, and how you're thinking through that in your hedge products.
Yeah, I think from a broad macro perspective, in a lot of ways, we're seeing a sort of very traditional late cycle style environment. And that's an unusual environment for because basically none of us have seen it in our professional lives or in our lives.
And I have, but I'm old.
It's one where, as we talked about, sort of that restructuring of the economy, and particularly the debt side of the economy, has made credit growth just a much lower, of much lower importance. You know, borrowing by households and businesses today is at recession-like levels. If you look at recession lows over the course of the last 50 years, we're basically there. There's not a lot of borrowing. And instead, what we're seeing is predominantly an expansion over the course of the last two and a half years that has been income-driven. And an income-driven expansion, in a lot of ways, is sort of like the most classic expansions that exist in the world, in the sense of, you know, if I earn a certain amount of income and I spend that income, that becomes, you know, my spending becomes someone else's income, and they take that income and they spend it.
Right.
And that is a very sustainable dynamic, because unlike borrowing driven expansions, there's no buildup of unsustainable conditions, right? If we just are all spending out of our income, you know, there's nothing going on, right? You know, our balance sheets are the same, and we get that GDP effect. I think, you know, that's sort of the underlying driver of this economy, and that's quite a durable expansionary dynamic. What's happened is that has led to a level of nominal spending that's too high relative to the productive capacity of the U.S. economy, led to inflation that's elevated relative to the Fed's mandate, obviously come down, but still is elevated relative to the Fed's mandate. And as is classic, central bank tightened a lot in order to respond to that, try and get the economy to slow down. It's just that in an income-driven expansion, you know, tightening is not particularly effective. It's not to say it's not. It's certainly not. It's hard to make a quantitatively driven case that it's stimulative. I think there's some people who are confused, who are sort of like, you know, I don't understand this, why this expansion is going on, so I think it's stimulative. It's not stimulative. It's definitely contractionary. It's just, it's not that contractionary. I mean, just think about it. If you're earning income, you know, have a 3% mortgage locked in, you own your car outright, you know, what do interest rates have to do with anything? Interest rates could be 2%, they could be 5%, they could be 7%. It like has no impact on your day-to-day life unless you're borrowing, right?
Right.
And so that's very persistent. And so it's just taking a long time for the economy to slow down in the context of that durable income-driven expansion.
There's also been a wealth effect as well in the investor class, right? I mean, if you're in the equity market, if your portfolio is 60% equities or something close to that, your costs, maybe some of your costs have gone up, like, you know, insurance and things like that have gone up around the home, not necessarily the home cost itself, but the mortgage, I mean, if you're locked in. But the wealth effect, I mean, there's a whole bunch of offsetting effects that are also contributing to that resilience of the consumer and you know, the employed. Just to point out a difference between, the U.S. and Canada, for example, where, you know, things aren't so great here comparatively, American mortgage holders are able to write off the interest on their mortgages as well. So, you know, not only, you know, maybe you're sitting on a 30-year mortgage at 3%, but you're able to write off the interest.
I think it's easy to forget in the U.S. context. Like, if you think about the median household, the median house, you know, 65% of Americans own their homes. The prices of those are going up. 60% of Americans are in the stock market. The prices of stocks are going up.
Right.
You know, 96% of Americans who want to be employed, who are in the labor market, are employed. And labor force participation amongst prime age workers in the U.S. is at multi-decade highs. And so you put that all together and you're like, people are employed. Their incomes are rising, you know, 4 or 5% a year. Their house prices are going up. And their stock, you know, their 401ks are going up. And like, you put that all together and like, you know, it's not, yes, prices have gone up and everyone feels that. And I think they probably feel it more from their sort of, from a confidence perspective, let's say, or from a, you know, a vibes perspective, that's, right. that's a drag. But from a balance sheet and cash flow perspective, like the median U.S. household is doing pretty well. And that is one of the reasons why this income-driven expansion can continue, that people feel comfortable enough to basically spend out of the income that they're earning and continue to drive the U.S. economy along, despite the fact that we've raised interest rates considerably.
Bob, can you help me think through the effect of interest rates on the economy, just generally speaking? So I'll lay out some thoughts. So the 70s, right? You had a spike in interest rates to control inflation. Lots going on. Boomers coming in, a big, you know, population bulge coming in, buying a lot of stuff, an oil shock and whatnot. You raise interest rates when an economy is, you know, sort of 30% debt to GDP. So the interest rates have an effect on the GDP side. There's also an effect on the debt side, but there's only 30% of GDP is, you know, the economy is lightly indebted. In the current paradigm where you're sitting at whatever, call it 1-to-1 debt to GDP, you raise interest rates to slow the GDP portion down, but there is an effect that's happening on the rate side where you've got all these boomers, you've got all these pension plans, you've got all of these pension plans related to cost of living and inflation. So you not only have the investment income where a boomer can sit down and say, well, I was getting 0, I'm now getting 5. So their income goes up. Yeah. All the pensions, their income goes up. And so there's like, help me balance those things. And that is probably, maybe it's uncalculable, but isn't there a difference in the impact of rates on the current situation? And then you printed something on this too, with respect to, you know, inflation, reshoring, right? Creating this inflation. The reshoring is kind of beautiful too, because you've got natural gas prices that have been held at all-time lows when it comes to thinking of those energy molecules compared to oil, as an example. And you're already seeing a massive transition to those types of things. So you have this reshoring going on. You have cheap natural gas everywhere, so you can kind of rebuild the whole industrial area of the U.S. Like, there are a whole number of things that could create a lot of growth in the U.S. that are going to push this inflation maybe beyond what everyone's expecting. And can you help me kind of work through that? The first part being, you know, is this debt to GDP, how does that impact things when you have rising rates? And then this reshoring that's occurring. I mean, I don't know. To me, it seems like inflation could be substantially higher.
On the higher rates and a higher debt environment, I think it's important to get down to the cash flows, you know, who's paying what.
Yeah.
As a function of those higher rates. And so if you think about businesses and households, their interest expense hasn't meaningfully increased, because mostly what they did is lock in low fixed term loans for a long time, or or issued long-term bonds. Yeah. And so a higher interest rate environment will be corrosive to their cash flows over, you know, if it existed for 5 or 10 or 20 years from now. As you have to refinance, like even homeowners, you know, people move, they die, they get married, they get divorced, whatever, like, you know, there's, you know, children, like people have to move. And so eventually those mortgages will be reset, but that's very, very slow moving. So if you just think about that, for those borrowers, there's not a lot going on in terms of the higher interest rate environment. Obviously for the government side, the duration of government debt is quite a bit shorter. Obviously 25% is in floaters, whatever, T-bills, and you know, a fair amount of the debt stock is getting repriced on an annual basis. That debt service has risen. And the question is, who earns that debt service? Who gets that debt service?
Yes.
A fair amount of that debt service goes either to non-GDP oriented savers, so like a pension fund, or it's going to rich people. And to a lesser extent, it's going to corporations. But mostly what's happening is it's going to, you know, if a pension fund gets 5% more income, what do? They go buy some financial assets, that's for sure, but they don't create GDP. If a household, a rich household, gets that income, remember, it's the last dollar in, right? And so, Matt, what does the spending profile look like for, let's just say, a homeowner or you know, a household who has $1 million of income? What's that dollar of, you know, $1 million to $1,001,000, right? Their propensity to spend that dollar is essentially zero, which is quite a bit different from, you know, traditional income growth. Let's say if you added the extra dollar to the median income, you know, at $50,000, it would be very different. And so the GDP impact of the higher debt service or the higher debt payments, particularly from the government, is relatively de minimis. And really the story is much more about the fact that, like, you know, most households, yeah, you know, 96% of households are earning or employed and they're earning income, and that income's going up 5% a year. Like that's pretty good in terms of when it comes to spending. I think the sort of longer term dynamic, which you point out related to the reshoring story, I think is really important. In the sense that when we went through, you know, most of us, all we've known up until COVID was like 40 years of disinflation, globalization, peace, all three of those very important, right, in driving this low inflation environment. And if you just sort of think about, you know, globalization rolling back and peace maybe not being as, you know, conflict not being as low as it has been over the course of the last 40 years, those things are very inflationary. Now, you know, onshoring is good for growth, good for U.S. growth, and bad for inflation, right? From the perspective of like what we did for 40 years was find the lowest cost producer in the world and have them produce it rather than have, you know, it produced domestically. So there's a trade-off there. There's many reasons why you might want to reshore supply chains, both, you know, economically as a business to create duplicate supply chains or durability in your supply chains. There's also, you know, geopolitical reasons why you might want to onshore your production. It's just a trade-off, though. It's good for growth and it's bad for inflation. That's all there is to it. And so I think part of that story is, you know, we've sort of all as investors and savers have looked at the world in this disinflationary growth, strong growth lens over the course of the last 30, 40 years, built portfolios that benefit from that, particularly like 60-40. But if we're instead going to maybe inflationary growth or inflationary weak growth, the portfolios that you want to have as a saver, long-term saver, are pretty different in those environments than what we've seen in the last 30 or 40 years.
Right. And this may be a point to maybe just switch gears a little bit into your new multi-strat portfolio that is thinking through the investment problem for allocators and savers and investors, and thinking through how these changes in regime, these longer-term changes in regime, affect your expectations around asset prices and how they might perform, whether that's, you know, bonds maybe being less negatively correlated with equities in an inflationary market, or the different types of equities that might perform in an inflationary environment versus an inflationary low growth environment, stagflationary environment. So maybe you can walk us through the regimes themselves and give us a little hint as to, you know, here's what kind of does well in this regime and here's something you could avoid. And contrast that, I mean, the disinflationary market we've had since, call it 82, has favored, you know, stocks and bonds and domestic stocks for, you know, the U.S. economy. Maybe walk us through that, the regime, the shifting, how you're thinking through that from an actual portfolio perspective.
Yeah, I think there's probably two lenses to think about this. The first is as a in building a strategic savings portfolio and what the implications are there. You know, when you're building a strategic savings portfolio, you want to put yourself in a position where you don't have to be calling regimes, right? And that, and the reason why that is for the vast majority of investors, people who don't spend their professional lives the way we do thinking about this stuff, like it's very hard to beat the market in terms of, you know, timing, in terms of picking assets, et cetera. And instead, you're just much better off positioning in a way that honestly, you can, you know, you get pretty good real returns over time, kind of no matter what happens in terms of right. the macroeconomic regime that comes with us. And so I think for most investors, they sort of have been riding on the coattails of the 64, you know, of disinflationary strong growth, 60-40 being the most efficient implementation of that. And that when they look ahead, you know, I wouldn't necessarily expect with as much certainty, you know, the 60-40 portfolio being the optimal portfolio to be balanced against a bunch of different dynamics, particularly since we're likely to see a higher probability of those different dynamics in the future. And so what that means is functionally for most investors, you get a lot of bang for your buck, just like out of that 60-40 in turn, you know, take some capital out of that 60-40, put 10% in gold, put 10% in diversified commodities, maybe add a little trend or diversified alpha to your portfolio. Like you don't have to like radically change your portfolio and hold all sorts of exotic stuff. Like, you know, take 20 or 30% of your portfolio, add some additional stuff with nice, you know, convexity to those dynamics, and you get a pretty good bang for your buck, and also actually not necessarily lose so much of the correlation, the sort of short-term correlation to 60-40, because obviously peer risk matters. And so I think from that perspective, that's really, you know, and we're in very early days. Like, you know, I talked to advisors and I mentioned gold and they like, you know, yeah. they think I'm a crazy person.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Gold is such a polarizing asset. Now, Canadians get gold, Europeans get gold, South Americans get gold. And they all get gold because in their memory is some inflationary event that was wealth destroying. You know, you can go through the European area and you can think through even going back to World War II and having to transport wealth and whatnot. That's still fresh in minds there a little bit. And then, you know, Latin America is full of inflationary stories where fiat currency was absolutely destroyed. Canada, we have a whole bunch of gold mines, so we are gold bugs too. But it is incredible as someone who deals across a number of global client bases that the U.S. is just, you know, you've got gold recently breaking out to all-time highs. At the same time, you've got gold moving from the London Exchange to the Shanghai Exchange because there is a premium based on that. And then you've got GLD's AUM going down 30% in the last 2 years. Like it is institutionally as well. I mean, that's how institutions would normally buy. If you look at the ETFs or the exchange traded products that represent gold, all of them, now they've started to pick up a little bit, but a severe contraction in allocation at the same time you're hitting new highs. I mean, that's an exciting trade to me.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think given the global demand for gold and actually particularly the demand sort of more tactically out of the East and out of China, because in the China context, you know, there's basically nothing else to save in China, mm-hmm. right? You can't move your money offshore. I mean, anyone who can move their money offshore is yeah. trying to do that. Yeah. But absent that, like houses are no good. Wealth, you know, the wealth management products, those have, you know, busted. Stocks are going down. Like you look at all those things, like where is there, you know, it's actually kind of, it's like fascinating. Like mm-hmm. when all else fails, what do you buy? Gold. That's yeah. the answer, right? And the reason why that is both because it can be seen as a storehold of wealth and it is, you know, durable, transportable, like all of the sort of monetary.
No debt. There's no debt right, against that.
There's no counterparty. Like yeah. all of those things are yeah. Also in China, I should say you can't invest in Bitcoin because, or at least you're not legally allowed to invest in Bitcoin because there's regulations against it. So like talk about like everything else is blocked. Like, people just go to the most basic stuff that's out there, which is that they invest in gold, which is what they've done, you know, what people have done for 5,000 years. And so I think that's very interesting, sort of tactically thinking about the gold market. So even if you had, let's just say, US-based investors, the average RIA account has less than 1% in gold. Yeah. Or said differently, only 10% of RIA accounts have any gold, gold in their portfolio, 10%. Right. And on average, those are just single digit allocations to gold.
And so
imagine just, you don't even need much of a reallocation. Just go from selling to not selling in the West. And that could be a huge impact on the gold price over time. So anyway, I think there's lots of, not to mention the fact from a macroeconomic standpoint, just an empirical standpoint. People lose sight of the fact that gold outperforms bonds half the time in equity drawdowns. So if you're looking at, you know, and can we talk about the last 5 years? Like, gold has outperformed bonds for the last 5 years in times of equity drawdowns, basically every single time. Okay, so but like
even,
this
even in the last 30 years, right? I mean, if you
even the last 30 years, yeah. I mean,
it's performed as well. I mean, without the, I mean, given that there's no income from gold, although you can get it now. You know, there's no income from gold compared to fixed income, compared to bonds. Gold has done as well, if not better.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. And so just if you are solely from an empiric basis, like the world, every investor holds bonds, every single investor, right? Talk to every advisor has their clients in bonds, and you're like, well, look, gold is, you know, equally as good as bonds as a diversifier to stocks. Like, zero seems like not the right allocation,
right?
To gold.
Well, and over the last 3 years, gold is up 28%, the S&P 33%.
Yeah,
so I mean, it's very similar, and they trade positions over the last few years as an example, and just nobody's interested.
Yeah. So anyway, I think, you know, those are the sorts of things that are generational. If you go back and, you know, if you're gonna find somebody who was trading in the 60s and the 70s, there's a few of them are still around. You know, they'll talk to you about gold all day long.
I came up under those guys. My formative years were under those guys telling me about those stories back in the day. And maybe we can just, you know, in the dynamics of inflation and growth, just to kind of give everybody, you know, you have these two dynamics that create four regimes. One of those regimes is the one that we've been in quite nicely for a number of years, which is disinflationary growth, where you have growth, but you also have attenuating commodity prices. And that really allows an economy to grow, and stocks and bonds, especially those domestic US type stocks and bonds, do really, really well. Contrast that to inflationary growth. We had that period, sort of call it 03 to 05, 06, where the world was growing, China was all coming together, and you had inflation, but you had global growth that could overcome the inflation. So the inflation wasn't stagnating the economy. So that's also another environment. That's where BRICS got popular. That's where gold had its run into 2011, you know, oil at $150 a barrel for a minute. So all those things happen in that regime. And then you get on the other side where growth is a little bit, you know, dodgier, and you can have high inflation or low inflation. So you end up in a stagflation period like the 70s. Where commodities do really well, gold does really well, emerging market debt does really well. And that's a very different environment. 60-40 doesn't really do well. That's kind of a 2022, that's a 1970s type environment. And then lastly, you have the, you know, the daddy of them all, the deflationary, non-growth, 1928, 30 scenario, the 2008 sort of scenario. We have that fourth regime, and that's what Bob's talking about, in fitting these asset classes, and these different asset classes perform very significantly differently in these regimes. And then, so Bob, you've got your sort of no harm portfolio that you think about. Let's not predict. Let's establish, you know, positions in those four regimes. Do you tilt? How do you know? So you've got your sort of long-term wealth accumulation strategy. I think that's what you're alluding to a little bit. What else do you do? Do you take some bets against that? Do you tilt? You've added some gold. You've added some trend following. How else do you manage around the expectations around these regimes?
Well, I think for most, you know, the reality is for most investors, you should not do that. You should not do anything other than build a good, robust strategic portfolio. You should definitely not make bets. Because the reason why that is there are people out there, the most sophisticated asset manager in the world, literally spending billions of dollars hiring the smartest people out of the top schools,
who have the best connections to the people, the best first.
exactly, who are out there trying to beat the market. And so if you're consulting in one direction or another, what you're doing is you're competing against people spending billions of dollars to beat you. And that is, a recipe for not, in any one month and any one year, it might look good, but over the course of, a 50-year savings portfolio, it's not going to work well. And so for most investors, what you're better off doing is trying to essentially hire those most sophisticated asset managers, and put some of your capital towards those strategies, and let them do the hard work day in and day out, in order to, do the tilts, basically. What are the highest probabilistic tilts in one direction or the other that you can do? I think the challenge with that, if you look at big sophisticated institutions, that's essentially what they do, is they have something like 75% of their portfolio is long only in one form or another, whether it be public markets or things like private equity or venture, which are basically long only portfolios. And then they put about 20-25% in sort of tactical portfolios, hedge fund strategies. The problem for most investors is that getting access to those top tier managers is really hard. And the reason why that is because they're really expensive. So they charge you 2 and 20. And then if you're, unless you're a big institution, like there's platform fees, there's advisor fees, fund fees, all sorts of stuff.
Breach.
there's all sorts of stuff like that. And even if you can invest in a particular manager, like if you invest in one manager, like who the heck knows, it's like, what's your confidence interval over a 3-year time frame for, let's say a macro manager, like let's say the index returns, 8% or 10%. What's your confidence interval for any one manager? Your 90% confidence interval is between negative 10 and positive 20. Like, okay, well, what is that? I mean, that's like going gambling. Like, that's not an asset return. That's not a knowable asset return. That is a collection of randomness that you have. So you have very expensive randomness is basically what most people can access. And so I think the thing that's really compelling, and part of the reason why I got into what I'm doing today, is much in the same way, 50 or 75 years ago, people would just buy like one random stock. And then over time recognize that buying, diversified indices is probably a much better way to do it, both lower cost and more diversified. So too should access to the, let's call it the 2 and 20 landscape or the hedge fund landscape. So too should investors be able to have access to something like that, a low cost diversified approach. And that's basically what we're doing. And with modern, the combination of frankly, experience, having done this work, having actually built the strategies, and a lot of innovation in terms of the techniques we can use for replication, as well as the infrastructure in terms of the products that we can use. You put that all together, we're really in sort of the cutting edge of a world in which every investor has access to diversified 2 and 20 at a low cost.
Yeah. And I don't think Bob's allowed to say it, but I'll say it. It's HFND is his replication product that seeks to replicate the best CTAs in the world in doing their allocating and tilting. And replication is a very interesting game, right? That has all kinds of its own challenges. One of the benefits, though, is, well, there's a couple major benefits. One is you're not paying those 20% carry fees. So you want to see that tracking error when the indexes in the CTA space, commodity trading advisor space, are going up, and you should see positive tracking here because you're not paying 20% of your profits when you're at new highs. The other thing, and I think a less appreciated feature of using replication, and we do some replication products as well, but is that manager risk that Bob so astutely points out, where, you bought a trend follower and in 2022, they could have done anywhere from -5 to +40. Right. And you're like, oh man, did I pick the wrong one? Do I have enough capital to have 10 of them? Rather, pick the replicator so that you get that meaty middle of the move. You just want to be in the middle. You want to be in the median plus the fee alpha. that's going to put you in the top quartile. And now you've got an allocation that you can sort of rely on because it's mimicking all the largest managers and it's pulling, you know, estimating their positions in various ways. And we can get into all the, we won't get into all that nonsense because that gets quite technical, but you know, you're getting that meaty middle for that, that diversifying approach. And in 2022, it would have helped handsomely as your stocks and bonds went down together. It's amazing how quickly people had forgotten about that. But those are a couple of features that I think are incredibly important for the index replication game, the fee alpha, and the fact that you don't have to worry about that manager risk. And it's quite large, you know, and you just don't want that. You want the meaty middle. And if you do 20, you don't want to give up 4 in performance fees to get 16. You want 20. And so that, yeah, those are the nice things that happen. Go ahead.
Mike, that was really, he did a really good job with that. That was, that was really good. How you described it.
I just wanted to get Bob's hiring.
You know what? You know what?
We're going to get that. I'm going to take that clip and use that for,
you know what I think is really funny. I think it's really funny how, you know, we got tricked in the market, you know, into thinking that beating the market was everything. And, you know, I mean, psychologically, the contest of beating the market is somewhat, you know, more exciting than some of the stuff we're talking about. But when people invest, you know, and you know, to your point, Bob, which is that, you know, you shouldn't be making bets. You should be investing across the landscape to take into account all the scenarios that could unfold, whether that's, you know, a strong equity market or strong bond market or strong economic or war economic landscape, whatever can go, you know, right or wrong, and not make any directional bets. But we've been sort of, you know, the language of the industry has always, to me at least, it's always been around, you know, beating the market, outperforming. You know, that's the language of fund managers, but it shouldn't be the language of investors, right? Like when you look at, you know, wealthy investors, endowments, institutions, ultra high net worth investors, they're not trying to hit the ball out of the park every year. If it happens, fantastic. You know, if it happens that the strategies that you're invested in are home runs in any given period, fantastic. But that's not the point. The point is to keep your money and to keep on earning a real return on that wealth and that, and you know, if it's an individual or family, or if it's an institution on that endowment, it's to build a sustainable portfolio. It's to build something that has everlasting qualities, not something that 3 years from now is going to be underwater because it took too much of a bet on AI stocks or something, or, you know, I think investors miss the point. And then there's this other perception, which is completely contrary to what Mike just described, which is that, you know, hedge funds were not created to behave like Bill Ackman. You know, Bill Ackman is an outlier, right? Bill Ackman takes these single stock activist bets. That's not a hedge fund. That's a single stock activist bet, right? It's maybe structured like a hedge fund, but that's what people think of hedge funds when they hear the word hedge fund. They think risky. They think, yeah, it's not the wealthy who think that. It's not the wealthy who seek these strategies who think it's risky. It's the uninitiated, the folks who haven't, you know, looked into hedge funds either because they were inaccessible or it was just something that was just so far out there for them. But I think when you're doing, Bob, bringing, you know, strategies like HFND to market is to make it possible for investors who never thought it was possible for them to get into that space, to add those elements to their portfolio so that they can have a more sustainable, more resilient portfolio in the long run, something that has an everlasting quality rather than, you know, down 5, you know, up 40% one year and down 20 another. You know, investors have been through a lot of pain. It's just surprising how long it's taking people to, hey, investors.
Investors, yeah, are riding a 60-40 with a you know, too sharp for the last 20. And that's not too sharp.
But yeah, that's assuming they stayed invested the entire time. What about GFC when, you know, the S&P closed, you know,
sure,
below, just below 667?
Sure. Yeah. No. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah,
yeah. The right, thing I think is so interesting is that prudent investment management will underperform 100% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of underperforming the shiny thing that you know, the smart person seems to be investing in.
Yeah.
And so that's a really interesting psychological challenge. Right? Because if you're an advisor or you're the investor themselves, what you're going to experience if you're building a long-term strategic portfolio or you're indexing, let's say, right? Even indexing hedge fund managers, yeah. 100% of the time, there's going to be something that looks better than what you're doing. But over time, people can't pick the thing that is like, they can't pick the thing, the asset that's likely to do better. Certainly the everyday investor can't. They can't pick which alpha manager is likely to do better. They can't pick which alpha strategy is likely to do better. So the reality is if you can't pick the asset, the manager, or the strategy, you're much better off creating diversification, because diversification allows for better compounding of wealth over time. The challenge with diversification and prudence and indexing is that you have to have the humility to recognize that you can't do those things. And that's the biggest challenge. The biggest challenge in asset management is a humility challenge. Mm-hmm. Because it's not an empirical challenge. All the empirical evidence suggests that you should use diversified low-cost indexing and balanced portfolios, right? All of the experience of people who've been around for a while, you know, goes in that direction. The economics, the prospective economic outcomes go in that direction. The thing that is getting in the way of us moving in that direction, of asset management moving in that direction, is the ego of people who think that they can invest better or pick managers better than they actually can. That's the main thing that's standing in the way of it. And so I think that's the, you know, that is the challenging thing. Certainly for my space, I can say, in terms of like manager selection, the manager selection world, that's the nubby thing. Until we get past that, until advisors, asset managers, allocators get past their delusional belief that they can pick, they will continue to underperform simple diversified indexation.
Diversification. Always having to say you're sorry.
That's exactly right. And the thing is, the benefits of diversification are known, right?
Yeah.
You can understand the benefits of diversification. Yeah. The ability to pick, super unknown. And I think actually one of the challenges, one of the neat things about having sort of been on the manager side of the 2 and 20 world is that you learn very quickly on the, you know, when you're running money, humility is you either have it when you enter or you get it pretty fast, because you're going to be wrong.
Or you wait tables. Or you wait tables because you're not.
Or you wait tables. No, that's totally right. That's totally right. Like, you know, if you talk to people who've been, you know, trading for alpha for a long period of time, like the people who've really been doing it well, like they will tell you, you know, 100 times all the mistakes that they've made and, you know, the errors that they've had and the lessons they've learned and, you know, and the humility that they have as a function of that. Like, that's great, because then I look at, you know, manager selection, I look at portfolio construction, I take those lessons of having actually had, you know, billions, tens of billions of dollars on the table and figuring out how do you manage that most effectively and the lessons learned there. And then look at that relative to the way in which allocators and individuals and advisors are operating today. And it's totally out of whack. Way, way, way too confident that they know what they're doing, even when presented with evidence directly to the contrary of their belief in themselves.
Evidence never changes one's mind on that type of thing. I will add though, you know, there is, and it's not easy, right? Being diversified and these things that Bob's talking about, it is not easy. And so as an advisor or an allocator on a board member who allocates endowments and things like this, everyone is subject to the behavioral vulnerabilities of being overconfident, of you know, having a recency bias and what's worked best, and you know, the tracking error around the major indices of their friends doing something when they're not doing that thing. And so, you know, that's where the concept of return stacking and return stacked portfolios on our side has come from, is to think through, well, if all the computational power that Bob alludes to is on the security selection, the S&P 500 is pretty efficient. So let's take the betas that advisors and allocators know, love, and trust. And rather than selling part of the portfolio to buy the diversifier, just stack it on top. And this can be done, you know, we've got a number of products that help you with this. Some of them, you know, we do some replication, but also we've got portfolios that lever sort of that basic stock bond portfolio. So if you're thinking of HFND, and you want to add it, but you don't want to give up the tracking error to the S&P because you might get fired by your clients. Well, then we have a product where you can stack one of these different return streams, like a hedge fund replication system like Bob has, and you're simply adding that return on top. So you're not sacrificing, you're not giving up the tracking error, and that gives you a much better opportunity to outperform both on a return basis, and more importantly, on a risk-adjusted basis, so that when the bullets are flying and you're sitting in the foxhole, you don't make the mistakes that you might make, as you mentioned, Pierre, in 2008. So there's lots of very neat solutions to this that investors can consider, and they're complementary to one another.
I mean, I think we've been, you know, romanticized, right? I mean, we've talked about, you know, this subject that I'm bringing up, which is that, you know, if you look at that, the wealthiest people in the world, the Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, Zuckerberg, Bill Gates, you know, they got that way by owning the stocks of their companies. Right. So we hear these stories and we fall in love with these ideas like, oh, you know, if Amazon's down 60%, I'm a buyer. Right. If Microsoft,
what about down, when it was down 90%?
Yeah, twice. 90 and Meta was down, and not so long ago, Meta was down 65%, right? So you look at that and you know, were those same folks who say such things, you know, yeah. were they in there scooping it up, you know, backing up the truck? And the answer is no, they weren't, because
yeah. Someone, you know, watched, there was buyers on the other side. And I think,
sure, the short coverers, the
Pierre, the thing that you're referring to, and I'd love to get Bob's take on this too, is when you're in the process of accumulating wealth, your goal is not to be diversified. Your goal is to be highly specified and highly levered. That's how you become Jeff Bezos, but that's the outlier. That's not normal. Those are outlier events where someone took on one specific business. That business happened to work out. It happened to be in a world, in a universe where that particular thing did great. I mean, the average NVIDIA employee is now worth $100 million, I read, just because of their share purchase plan. Now, the guy took the job at NVIDIA instead of over at XYZ Corp that went bankrupt. I don't know. But accumulating wealth is about focus, concentration, and leverage. And it's not the same thing as managing wealth that's already been accumulated. And they're managing that wealth for a particular use case. In most cases, there's some sort of income coming from these portfolios on a regular basis. So now you can't have a 90% drawdown. You're not in the world of highly specific, highly levered, focused investing. You're in the world of, no, I've got a portfolio. I've got to consider all these regimes. And if I think through it a 50-year lens, if I truly have a long-term time frame, 5 years isn't long enough, 10 years isn't long enough, it's nonsense. You have a 20-year time frame, what's the portfolio that you would start with for the next 20 years? And I think that circles all the way back to Bob's conversation about building something robust to all the regimes. making sure you're not taking bets and things like that. But Bob, Pierre, throw it back to you guys for.
I think for most investors, I think that that distinction between a wealth, you know, a long-term savings portfolio and what that should look like, and essentially your wealth creation engine, let's say, I think those two, that's a very important distinction, in part because once you've created a certain amount of wealth, you want to be able to rely on that. And part of the challenge is you actually don't know the day that you're going to need that. And so I think, you know, a lot of people sort of say, well, maybe this asset has a higher longer term return. Yeah, that's possible, but it doesn't, but you may need it, you know, you may know when you need it, like your kid goes to college and you need it. And that's, you know, obviously, you know, when that is, which is, you know, 18 years after they're born, give or take. But there's lots of times where people have financial events that are unexpected. And so that's why in your savings portfolio, building long-term real wealth, but building it consistently is very important, because the worst thing you could possibly do is take a 60% drawdown and then sell in that moment, which then, you know, halves or changes the amount of compound wealth that you can come up on the upside. So that's why return consistency is so important on the savings portfolio. And I think one of the things that people underway through that as well is the effect that the volatility in your savings portfolio has on your ability and focus to do wealth generation in your day to day, which is, if you're worried about exactly what's going on in your savings portfolio, like, it will distract you from going out and being excellent at whatever you're doing.
Great point.
And I don't know how many people I talk to who are like looking at every tick of their savings portfolio and not, and like, you know, on Twitter and, you know, distracting themselves about how exactly they're going to do that. Rather, you know, you still be on Twitter and follow all of us on Twitter, but mostly for entertainment, not for managing the day-to-day undulations of your savings portfolio. You know, you just get distracted by it. And like a good savings portfolio, just for context, a good savings portfolio, you should probably only open the statement once a year, and you should trade on one day a year. That's a good savings portfolio. And you know, if you can do that and not think about it, think about it at all, other than that, whatever your one random day, I always like to trade like the Monday of Thanksgiving week because it was a quieter time. You know, if you could do that, then you've built a good savings portfolio. Then it's doing what it's supposed to be doing. You're running at the right volatility. You've got enough diversification. You're not worried. If you are week to week trading NVIDIA and Microsoft and Tesla and this and that, not a savings portfolio.
Yeah.
Right. That's a negative expected value trading portfolio. Now, some of us, of course, like to trade, and, you know, in part it's entertainment and in part it keeps us in the markets. If you're going to do that, that's totally fine. Like, it's totally fine. But just separate. Those are two separate points.
Yeah, exactly.
Have a different account. Open up a different account.
Yeah.
Don't. And I actually think on the savings portfolio, like, one of the things that advisors are actually particularly good at is they increase the transaction costs. If you have a good advisor, what they do is increase the transaction cost of you mucking with your savings portfolio, right? Because, you know, if you have a financial advisor and they're controlling it, and then you got to call them, and then, you know, you got to like explain to them why you want to change it. And then, you know, a good advisor will basically help you stay the course and help you. That's the best advisor you can get, is someone who helps you stay the course, understands your goals, helps you stay the course. And there's tons of people who fulfill that responsibility super well. I mean, not to mention the planning part of it, which is very valuable given the complexities of that. If you want to trade, you know, open up an Interactive Brokers account.
Well, or even
throw some dough in there.
That good advisor.
And trade it.
Maybe he opens up a cocktail portfolio for you.
Exactly.
This is the thing we've had, is like, okay, it's boring to be diversified, and I am looking for a little entertainment. Oh, you're looking for a cocktail portfolio.
Yeah, that's a good way to
describe it. So we're going to sin a little. We're going to take 5% of your net worth or something like that. And we're just going to do that cocktail party and, you know, buy the craziest things that absolutely can't work. That's, right. Yeah. And then And then you'll find, holy shit, some of that stuff actually does work if you can tolerate the risks that come along with it and you can put some risk management in it. Maybe you could do something there, but it's actually anathema to how you are built to behave as a human. But again, sin a little, name it to tame it, you know, call it your cocktail portfolio and then go to your cocktail parties and tell people you own a little NVIDIA and you own, you know, whatever else other stock you want to insert right here.
Well, yeah, but that's about, terrific. Yeah.
When you think about your long-term wealth on it, though, that portfolio, you should hold it as if it's like, put it at zero in terms of your wealth.
Yeah.
It's a zero.
You expect a negative sort of variance.
You expect a negative expected return.
Yeah.
That's right. So book it at zero and isolate it and trade it, but just keep it away from the way that you're operating your savings portfolio.
I lost my train of thought for a second. that's a really great way to show your client what could have been if, you know, like it's like the Christmas, you know, the Christmas story, right? Christmas Carol, like the ghost of Christmas past, right? But except that you're showing the client, here's what your portfolio, you know, the portfolio you want to be able to talk about at cocktail parties, right? But look at how it, you know, over the long term, they're going to see how it turns out. If it turns out great, wonderful. But if it doesn't, it's a reassurance that what they're doing on their core portfolio is what's really important, is being diversified, sticking to it. You know, it's a sandbox, right? Now, you're giving them a place to go and play, which relieves that pressure, provides the outlet,
that urge,
right? It's casino night.
Yeah. So Bob, you also mentioned the right vol.
Yeah.
And that sort of lends itself to leverage and thinking through the balance in the portfolio, you know, sort of the 60-40 portfolio is basically 90% stocks in the way its variance goes. Maybe can you just shed some light on that? Maybe how you think through leverage, how you think about the volatility targeting. Can you kind of give us the galaxy brain of Bob Elliott on that sort of thing?
Well, I think it really does come back to the behavioral aspect of being able to stick to the plan. And so, I think for most investors, let's say holding 60-40, it's just, it's way too much equity risk. It's just, it's ridiculous. And when you think about volatility of your savings portfolio, it's a behavioral question. And what that behavioral question is can you stick to the game plan? And when I say stick to the game plan, what I mean is stick to the game plan where you open up the statement one day a year and you trade one day a year. Like that's the game plan that you need to stick to. And so you need to be able to take, you could take as much volatility as you can that allows you to continue to operate consistent with it. Because the biggest risk that you have in building that long-term savings portfolio is deviating from the game plan at inopportune times. And so that's really the question. I think, people talk about, well, stocks go up, or have gone up something like 10 to 12% a year. You can, in a diversified portfolio, build a portfolio that delivers similar levels of returns over time with less monthly volatility or lower drawdowns, particularly on a real basis. And so it's not even clear you have to give up expected return to have better diversification, to get more return consistency for the vast majority of investors. But even if you did, I think this general idea of running a portfolio, people are pretty good at dealing with a 10% expected volatility or something like that, 10 to 12% expected volatility. What that means is, like, in an extreme situation, you're going to lose about 20%. That's like, I'd say that's right on the cusp of willingness. If you lose more than 20% from peak, you probably are going to start changing your behavior. So running a portfolio is sort of the volatility of, between, roughly 10%, 8 to 10%, puts you in, a pretty confident that you're not going to find yourself in that position, particularly with a diversified portfolio. And just to be clear, like, if you just primarily invest in 60/40 year stocks, which is essentially stocks, you've been below 20% a lot in COVID, in 2022, in 2008, in 2000. Like, you have experienced a lot of those 20% drawdowns, which would probably have changed your behavior.
And that's in a good
regime. And it's surprising. I mean, bad
regime. And yeah, in an ideal regime, not to mention the 70s.
Yeah.
Precise. Period as well, for sure. And you know, and that's just in a regime in the United States, which happens to have been the best performing equity market of any equity market globally over the course of the last 75 years. And so, you know, if you just think about like the universe of regimes, like the odds that if you're a primarily stock directed portfolio or in a high beta stock portfolio, the odds that you go below 20% and start to change your behavior are very high. And you just don't want to be there.
Love it. Well, Sam, yeah,
excellent.
What do you think, gents? We wrap there.
I got one last question.
Oh yeah, go for it. Yeah,
Bob, what is the best advice you've ever received or given?
The best advice I've ever received or given, probably your best guess of whether you can make money in markets should be that you cannot make money in markets, that you have no alpha. That should be your baseline assumption, is that you do not know how to pick managers, assets, or strategies. And you have to have a very high bar to believe that you can. And if you start there and work from there, you're going to be in a lot better shape than if you start from overconfidence in believing that you have a great deal of skill and ability.
That's fantastic.
Well said.
I mean, this is one of the most humbling businesses to be in. And, you know, as an investor, as a manager, as a fund manager, you know, that's terrific.
The beautiful thing about managing money is that there's never a day when you get it perfect by any stretch. And so the more optimistic way of looking at it is there's always something to learn, right? That's always keeps you on your toes.
Love it. Well, Bob, thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time, and yours too, Mike, and insights. That was amazing. That was an amazing discussion. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.